Welcome to Meeple to Meeple, uniting players around the world. A 30-minute exploration of PJ and Gareth's four-game experiences from across both sides of the Atlantic. Each episode, they share their thoughts and opinions on the world of board games, including their favourite themes, games, hot topics, and much, much more.
Hey guys, and welcome to episode 71, Fled, Can You Escape? As always, I'm PJ.
And I'm Gareth.
And today we've got a special guest. We've got the designer of the up-and-coming game that's going to be launched tomorrow on Kickstarter, Mark Swanson of Fled. How are you, Mark?
Pretty good. How are you guys doing?
Great. We're glad to have you on. It's great to finally meet you.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
And then to discover that we're like an hour away from each other as far as where we live, which is so cool.
We totally need the game.
Yes.
Yeah, that's, yeah. No, I've got no FOMO on that, missing out on some more gaming. Happens to be all around where PJ lives. But yeah, so Mark, I've seen Fled appear on my socials over the last month or two. He's definitely been dialing up. And with the launch, it's the 5th of March at 2 p.m. UK time. I think it was 9 a.m. Eastern time.
That's right.
Do you want to give us an overview of Fled and the concept behind it?
Yeah, sure. Well, I based the game after Spike Island, which is a British fort turned island prison off the south coast of Ireland. Maybe you've heard of that place.
I'm Googling now. I'm clearly missing out on some.
Basically, Ireland's Alcatraz. And so back in the mid-1800s, the British government sent young lads there for minor infractions, like stealing a potato during the Irish potato famine. And Fled is like a game that I've always wanted to make. You know, I've always loved movies about escape. So, you know, like obviously Shawshank Redemption comes to mind, but also some old ones. Count of Monte Cristo is an escape movie, Escape from Alcatraz. And so another thing that kind of motivated me is one of the very first Euro-style games that I ever played that kind of introduced me to the hobby was a lighter weight game called Cartagena, which is a pirate-led jailbreak from a fortress. That was back in the early 2000s. I played the game, and inside the box there was a pamphlet on other Euro-style games. I'm like, this is different than American games. And that's what launched me into the hobby. And so in a way, this is kind of a tribute to the very first Euro that I played as well.
And what, so you're escaping from the Victorian prison. It's 2 to 4 players?
Yes. Well, there's a solo and multiplayer variant as well. So technically 1 to 4 players.
Yeah.
But, you know, I first started thinking about this when I played Carcassonne many, many years ago. I love tile placement games. And so at some point I began to envision a modular tile placement mechanic where like a prison would grow as the game progressed. And every tile in the game is a dual purpose tile that can be played to form the prison or traded to secure the tools that you need to escape.
And I think I've been watching the how to play video, and they, you know, actually it's 6x6 left to right and 6x6 above. So it really does grow like those Carcassonne maps. And I think the tiles are, they can be windows, they can be doors. So you're trying to build out the prison that both suits your, I guess, your escape route, but also hinders other people as well.
Right. There are warders, as they used to call them, wardens or guards in the game. And you can play a tile with a little whistle on it that activates the one of the warders in the game. And then you can move that guard closer to your opponent in hopes of shackling that person to essentially slow them down or eventually sending them back to their bunk. You have to kind of balance thwarting your opponent's progress without making your own progress.
Because it really looks like the as the map grows out, you've got that. Every round you have to play a tile that's mandatory out of your hand, and then you have to use tiles for their each got different icons. So you can use some for soaring through bars, which I think is the file, and you've got the boots for walking through pathways. So you've got that whole, oh, what tile do I play to move on? But at the same time, you need to keep the tiles back to progress. It's a really fine
balance.
Right.
That's right. You're kind of navigating your way through a labyrinth of corridors and rooms, a mess hall, a yard, a courtyard, different rooms in the prison. And you have different tools like a file or a key or a boot that allows you to move through an open corridor or through a locked door or through, you know, bars. And you have to work your way to certain rooms so that you can find contraband, like stamps or buttons, that you then eventually will trade for the tools that you need to escape. So it's kind of like a, first you look for contraband, then you trade them for the tools you need, and then you are ready or in a position to make it over the wall.
And do people always escape?
Yeah, not always. No. I would say most of the games. I mean, my wife and I play this all the time now. And it's almost, I'd say, 90% of the time that we escape.
Okay.
Well, both of us escape because one person can escape and then everyone else has one extra turn.
Okay.
Usually multiple players can escape, but it's the one that earns the most victory points that wins.
So I'm really curious about, so you have the chaplain, which is kind of a helpful warder. But what's the story with the combs? Gareth and I are both bald men, so we don't relate to combs.
So any, you know, any life in prison is hard. So anything that's kind of a luxury item, like stamps or buttons, you know, the prisoners have to use alternative currency, right? Mm-hmm. So a grooming tool or a stamp or a button, those are, you know, you can trade those essentially for other more valuable items like a key, a warder's key. And so that's the story behind the comb.
Okay.
And each contraband item is related to a particular room. So combs can be found in the washroom. Plum cake can be found in the mess hall. A stamp can be found in a bunk. So there's kind of a thematic association with the contraband that you're collecting.
So since you brought it up, I've got to ask, how does one shank someone with a plum cake?
Yeah, you're referencing Ryan Creighton from Nights Around the Table. He loves to poke fun here and there, but he used that phrase, taking a plum cake to shank your opponent, just to kind of allude to, I guess, more some of the more sinister things that happen
in prison. Yeah.
Right.
And we said it's one to four players. Any difference in scaling? Does it play well 2, 3, and 4, or is there any rule mechanics or anything change?
Yeah. So in the 3 and 4 player game, you actually play with 6 more tiles.
Right.
To accommodate more players. But so it plays really well with 2, 3, or 4. And then, I've worked hard to develop the solo player variant, which introduces a ghost called the Spectre, which is actually based on a ghost in Spike Island that is part of history. So all of the elements of the game relate to some aspect of the prison's history.
I need to go and do some research on Spike Island.
In the back of the rule book, there's actually names. Every meeple color is related to an actual character in history that was imprisoned at Spike Island. And one fella, for instance, was guilty of stealing the constable of in England caught him for stealing a pint of milk. And then later he stole an entire cow. And so he went to Spike Island. Another fella was caught for being married to 2 women at one time. And, you know, of course, bigamy was not allowed. So Spike Island, he went.
I'm just looking at photographs of it now. I mean, it's incredible. Yeah. It's stunning. How both did scenery you, and the size of it.
How did you learn about Spike Island? Like, how did you learn about this story and then decide I'm going to make a game around this?
Well, like I said, I've always been interested in prison movies. And mm-hmm. so I was looking at, you know, world famous prisons and stumbled onto Spike Island and started reading about the history and found it fascinating. It's kind of tragic because, you know, in this case, we're rooting for the prisoners because more often than not, they were thrown in there for stuff that we would just kind of roll our eyes at.
Right.
So, you know, the British guards are the kind of the villains in, and no offense, Gareth, but the villains in the game. and you're rooting for the prisoners, some of them, which were, you know, 15, 16 year olds that were down on their luck and had to swipe a potato.
Mm, that's interesting. Yeah, I'd never heard of this story, and I'm a historian, so I'd never heard this. I was looking up. I was like, I wonder how do you find this? It seems kind of obscure and hidden, but so fascinating. So that's pretty cool. Was there a book that you discovered, or was it just kind of like a specific inspiration or?
Yeah, several books and some online literature too.
Sure.
I can't remember. I have it lying around here somewhere, but I'll have to tell you about it.
Have you spoken to the prison themselves? Have you spoken to the prison themselves to get any research out of them?
No. Spike Island has a website, and so I did
a bit of research
from them. In fact, I'm hoping to actually visit Spike Island on a future trip to Ireland.
Yeah. I must admit, it looks good. It's a bit of history I never knew anything about. So there we go. There's a whole part of Ireland I need to go and do some visiting to. How long has the game taken to design to the point today?
A little over a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything about the design process that's been challenging or which has it been a smooth experience from you from concept through to testing through to today?
Well, anytime I do a design, four things are super important to me. The story, the mechanics of the game, the art, and then production value. You know, you have to have a killer theme, unique mechanics, spectacular art. And Clemens Franz is the artist of this game. You probably know him from Agricola, Caverna, Le Havre, recently Boone Lake, just amazing style. And then quality bits. You know, these meeples have UV printing where it's actually engraved in the wood itself.
Oh, okay.
It's not like
silkscreen.
Screen where it's kind of like a glossy sticker. Yeah. Applied to the meatball. I don't like that. I like stuff that's either layered on there as an actual print, like a two or three color print, or if there's multiple colors, I think UV is the best.
Because the images, I think that's what, when I first saw the images of appearing on, like, let's say Instagram, they really pop, like the little characters, the wardens, and the convicts. Those shots of them inside their cells just really stands out as artwork on their own. And I say, you do recognize Clemens Franz's work as soon as you see it. So was that a straight yes from him in terms of doing the artwork?
It's funny because when I called Clemens, or didn't call him, I actually emailed him. I didn't know what kind of response I would get. You know, here's this world famous artist. And right off the bat, he said, oh, yeah, I know you. Yeah, you did Feudum. I said, oh.
Oh,
you know
me.
Wow.
Maybe I'm the famous one.
Yeah.
But it was great. And so he said, I'm in. I mean, I got to believe that, like, there are hundreds of folks that want him to design their game.
Yeah.
And so I felt great about
it. Amazing.
Meeting him via email and then working with him has been a breeze. So he's very responsive. He works quickly. He's extremely polite and professional. It's been a joy to work with him.
And how much of a brief do you give? Do you just give the concepts of the game and some style, or does that come from?
Yeah,
not being an artist.
All the artists that I work with, though, if you could hear them talk, they would tell you that I probably over-deliver when it comes to reference material because I'm very particular. You know, I like to direct my creative very closely. I allow for the artist's style and uniqueness to shine through. I don't try to be, you know, push their pen, so to speak, but I do have, but I'm familiar with their work. And so with Clemens, you know, his style is very unique and pretty consistent.
Yeah.
But there are some deviations. So I had to kind of home in on a particular style that he has done and show him references of his own work. This is the kind of work I like.
This is what's good.
And he was pretty good about following that and very open-minded when I said, could you do this a little bit more? And then, of course, at the last minute, almost the 11th hour, I said, hey, you know, I've been thinking about a play mat. People have been asking about a play mat. He delivered that, you know, 11th hour, and it looks fantastic. So I'm excited about the play mat.
I can't wait. So we've talked about the story. We've talked about, I guess, the art and design. How's the production? So this goes live today, which is the day of the show. What can backers expect in terms of production?
In terms of how long it will take to produce?
Yeah, and I guess components, and is there a deluxe copy or is it just a straight standard copy for everybody else?
Yeah. No, there are three reward levels. There is the Kickstarter edition that comes with all the stretch goals, which will be unveiled as certain goals are earned. And then the stretch goals have to do with historic aspects of the prison. So Clemens designing tiles that are specifically related to the history of the prison. And that's what a lot of backers have told me, that they like stretch goals that have to do with gameplay, not superfluous extras.
Yeah, completely.
They want gameplay to be enhanced. So that's what I focused on. There's the main reward level, and then there's a reward level with the solo variant, and then there's the reward level with the main game, the solo variant, and the playmat.
Nice. So, what is your favorite feature of FLED, whether it be a rule or a component or anything in the game that's your personal favorite that you're really proud of?
Well, I love games that truly have unique mechanics. You know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the usual fare of area control and worker placement and action programming or hand optimization. I mean, you name it. There's a slew of mechanics out there. But I think it's important to set a game apart with something that hasn't been done before. You know, games have multiple cogs that work together to run the machine. But if you can make one of those cogs unique, then you're onto something. And so with FLED, there's this element of a dual use tile where you have a tile in your hand, a series of five tiles, and any one of them could be placed to expand the prison. But then you could also need to hold some back because they have a contraband or a tool icon on them that you might be able to use in a better way. So there's this this management of resources and tiles in your hand that you're thinking about, and then the order of playing them becomes very important. And I think that's kind of unique. And so I hope people will get excited about that and discover all the strategies when they play.
I think when I watched the playthrough, that's the bit that I was like, oh, that's the delicious decision making part. If I'm going to be in a bit of a spin here because this is going to be really useful, but if I give that up, then I'm not going to be able to deal with this. And how much forward planning can you do? How many rounds could I? Two or three? How?
If I'm so after you lay a tile in the prison, you play two more actions and then you replenish your hand. And one of the actions that you can do is, let's say there's a tile that you really would like to use, but you don't. It's premature. You want to use it later. One action is you can surrender that tile to the governor. Now, later on, when you're replenishing your hand, one of the tiles can be replenished from the governor's inventory. You can take back the tile that you had previously put there. However, while it's in the governor's inventory, some other players potentially grab that tile. So it's kind of a temporary place to store something you might need later, but look out, someone else might grab it.
It's a bit of high risk strategy.
Yeah.
Another thing I saw was the way that if you get caught, then you get the ball and chain.
Right. If you play a whistle tile and move a warder onto an opponent's space, then you get to draw from one tile from their hand, flip it over, and then it connects right to that player's prisoner tile, and it depicts that prisoner with a little shackle. Just simply means that that player has a negative one victory point at the end of the game. But if that player gets caught again, he has to go all the way back to his bunk. He is deshackled at that time, but now he's kind of has to start from that central location again. It's forgiving in the sense that you can kind of start over again, but it doesn't necessarily, devastate you, because with the right tools, you can navigate pretty quickly around the prison, especially with spoons. Spoons allow you to kind of tunnel multiple tiles away. So if you have a couple of spoons in your hand, you can, shoot across the prison pretty quickly.
Yeah, I do like that. The one spoon or two spoons, or you can make a musical instrument, was also an option on the video. I think that's the thematic part of it. Whether it's the shackle, which is when you flip it over and you build out that piece versus, the files, it all fits together really smoothly. When do you think this will ship? I know that's a tricky one with a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
How far away? Is this a year or is this?
Yeah, no. Well, so it all kind of comes down to the manufacturer and whether or not all of your I's are dotted and T's are crossed. And so I have, once the campaign funds, knock on wood, then it's usually a 6 or 7 month process. So, I pull, a month after the campaign goes by, all the orders are confirmed through BackerKit. And then I pull the trigger with Panda, and then Panda will take, six months essentially to have it ready to ship to all the worldwide hubs. So that means that it could ship as early as September.
Yeah.
Nice.
Fingers crossed. That would be amazing.
Right. Yeah.
What did you learn from the Feudum campaign? Because I think you did three or four. I can't remember
right.
now.
Right.
Yeah, Feudum was my first baby. Its popularity took me by surprise, truthfully. It was kind of a game that kind of combined my love of medieval fantasy with my growing love of strategic Euros. It's also kind of echoed my obsession with economic games that reward resource management.
Mm-hmm.
But the success of it has caused me to do three print runs. And now I'm doing a fourth print run in the form of the Septennial edition of the game on GameFoundry. And it's going to feature, some art additions to the board, a special clockwork behemoth, and a few other surprises. But I've learned basically everything about the international game publishing business that you can imagine. I mean, in the early days, I gleaned all the information I could from James Matthey's site, Rest His Soul, as well as the Stonemaier blog.
Yeah.
Other, fellow publishers that have kind of been there, done that, and learned all about localizing games internationally. Like Feudum is in 11 different languages. And there are worldwide localization partners in so many different languages. I learned that there are very dedicated fans that will email me and will send me packages with their game expansion ideas.
Okay, yeah.
And you know, initially I was like, "Uh-oh, you know, what are you doing? Get a life." But then I realized, hey, some of these ideas are good, and I found myself collaborating with fans out there. In fact, Rudders and Ramparts, which was a artisan edition set of castles and vessels, was all inspired by a very dedicated fan who sent me emails of drawings and painted miniatures and 3D sculptures that he and a sculptor worked on.
Wow.
And they were so amazing that I said, hey, I'm not going to ignore you this time. let's talk. And we collaborated. And of course I gave them credit on the Rudders and Ramparts page. And now I probably talk to him once a month.
Amazing.
Mm, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So what, because you've learned, it sounds like you learned so much. What one piece of advice would you give to a new designer getting ready to publish a game?
I'm going to share, I think, the first sentence out of Jamie Stagmeyer's A Crowdfunder's Guide to Kickstarter. You don't have to launch tomorrow.
Mm.
There's kind of this inane sense of urgency where people think, oh gosh, I better do everything quickly and get it out the door. But
you
have to have everything ready. You know, you have to build a presence on social media. You have to have a, you know, presence on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and, you know, a website with a landing page and start collecting emails about people who are interested in your launch. And that takes time. You have to go to the cons because, you know, even if you don't have anything to sell or even if you don't have a prototype, going to the cons helps you understand the business better, and you inevitably will meet people that play an instrumental role in your company's growth. And you don't even see it coming. You just go there and you meet people and you network, and before you know it, you're learning and you're better able to navigate the business. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you have to kind of immerse yourself. It's hard for it to be a part-time thing.
Right.
I think it's a shift I've seen back, I guess. Mm-hmm. I've been doing Kickstarter since 2012, where people were doing it as a part-time thing, and they're the ones that often got in trouble. But, you know, these days, yeah, the like you say, the prep work you see put in whether that's the socials or whether that's playtesting or just engagement, like at cons, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest decisions that a would-be entrepreneur has to make is, do I want to self-publish, or do I want to what they call speed date at a convention and talk to other indie publishers or even big publishers who will then enter into a royalty agreement? So I either Z-Man Games meets me at a conference and they like my idea and they say, we'll give you 5-7% royalties and we'll handle all the manufacturing, all the marketing, we'll take creative control of your game, we'll choose our own artist, and you know what? We're going to change a few rules as well. If you're okay with that and you're okay with getting 5-7% royalties, then you'd better hope that that game sells millions of copies, because 5-7% is, you know, 5-7%.
Yeah. Right.
Or alternatively, you do everything yourself. And that is a lot of work.
That's a lot of work.
That is, you know, trying to figure it all out. And you have to be smart about what you don't know. You have to understand, you have to be self-aware and know what is good artwork. You know, you don't want to put out something that's shoddy. What are good mechanics? Has the game been thoroughly play tested? Do you have a social media presence? Have you engaged with enough influencers and have you been on any podcasts like Meeple to Meeple, yeah. for example?
Thank you for that. Thank you.
It is, I think it is that, I mean, you said, have you got a good story? Have you got the right design? Yeah. Have you got the right artwork? And then the production, there's just those four alone. There's a shape of advice and guidance that, you know, that all of them are complex. Even that production part that you say Panda, but people have tried so many different routes. And obviously people see things and visually quite quickly, and you can, you know, you can start to lose traction just on the fact that the components are subpar.
Yeah.
It's a tricky one to navigate.
Yeah,
for sure.
I've got one last question for you, Mark. It's probably the most difficult question of the show. What is hitting your table right now?
Oh, wow. There's a game about throwing lavish parties in Victorian England called Obsession.
We didn't prime you about this, did we? Promise.
We did not.
So we talk about Obsession nearly every episode. It's a bit of an in joke that we talk about.
Oh, interesting.
So, tell us more about Obsession.
Yes.
Well, I was at a local miniature market, and I was waiting for a friend who was late. He was 10 minutes late, 20 minutes late. I'm like, okay. And then just some random guy's like, hey, we need another person at our table. We're playing this game. I'm teaching him. I'm like, okay. I sat down. Met a complete stranger. He taught me Obsession along with a couple other folks. And it was, you know, tableau build. Well, you know it, right?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Getting to boss a bunch of servants around, I guess. And throwing lavish parties and then, you know, being self-deprecating about being a rich American because you kind of guess points if you're a rich American, uncouth American.
Yep.
But, the theme of the game meshed really well with the mechanics, and it was just fun.
Yeah.
So I've been playing that with my wife a lot. She's beat me the last three times in a row. I can't figure it out. Let's see what else. I don't know, some oldies. You know, I've been playing a little bit of Goa.
Okay.
I've been playing Raw. What else have I played? Got to look at my my bookshelf. Oh, there's a game called, you remember Era? It's a game called Era where it's almost like you have a pegboard into which you put medieval buildings and then you surround it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like yellow pegboards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then there's floods and disasters. And
yes.
Little bridges and... Each building does something a little different, and you roll dice to gather resources and whatnot. That's a fun game.
It's a great game. Yeah, I always wonder whether there's going to be any more eras, or are they stopping there?
I've purchased every.
Yeah, expansion. Yeah. I think I'm missing two of the little boxes, and then they're really hard to find. So
they are not
absolutely
really hard to find. we had Dan. Dan Halligan on the show when they did the last Kickstarter.
Yep. Back in October.
Back in October. So that's worth a listen. Anyone who wants to know more about Obsession. Because, I think that's one of the games when we got PJs coming over in a couple of weeks' time to the UK. So Obsession will be one of the first games I think we're going to have to play, PJ. Dressed up in Victorian costume, of course.
I've got my silk top hat. I'm coming. Yep.
Yeah, tea and scones and jam and any other English tradition I can find. So thank you, Mark, for joining us today.
Yes.
Campaign for anyone who's listening is live on the 5th of March. How long's the campaign on for?
30 days.
So please do go and check out Fled. They'll be on our socials today, on all channels. So with links to the Kickstarter if you can't find your way there. Otherwise, best of luck,
Mark,
with this one. And I think we'll speak to you again with the Feudum release in a few more months' time.
Sounds good to me, guys.
Okay. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Please subscribe. And as always, we love to hear your thoughts and ideas. So make sure to leave those in the comments. And don't forget, you can also chat with us both on Instagram @MeepleToMeeple.